Hadar. Actually, I had the very good fortune of being a student here several years ago and spending a lot of time in this very room. I want to welcome everyone here. I see some familiar faces. For those of you who've been here before, you know what a dynamic and exciting place Makom Hadar is. For those of you here for the first time, you're about to get a taste of that. And we hope that will entice you to come back many, many more times for a myriad of programs that we offer. Tonight is a conversation between two of the founders of Makom Hadar, Rabbi Shai Held and Rabbi Ethan Tucker. Before I turn it over to them, I do want to mention that while Hadar tries to make its programs as accessible as possible to as wide an audience as possible, we would always appreciate your financial support. And in that vein, if you'd like to contribute via the website or via envelopes that you can see on your way out or learn more about Hadar, please engage me after the program or Rabbi Held or Rabbi Tucker or Rabbi Comfer. From Ruby Shackman, our Director of Development, and we'd love to hear your thoughts on the program, and we welcome your feedback. Without any further ado, let me turn the program over to Rabbi Shai Held and Rabbi Ethan Tucker.
Thanks. Thank you, Dan. Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us here tonight. In lieu of an introduction, just going to get right down to business. We are going to set about the task of essentially interviewing each other, otherwise known as having a conversation. We're going to start. I'm going to interview Ethan. Along the way, we'll stop and take some rounds of questions from the crowd. Then we'll reverse roles. And then at the end, we'll have a round or two of questions for both of us together. So I'll start with this. If people in the Jewish community associate you with one thing, it's probably the discourse of halakha as values. And I want to just ask you to begin by saying, first of all, what does that mean? And second of all, maybe at least as importantly, what does that not mean?
So halakha and values, which I would say is not even language that I myself all the time use, though I think have come to embrace, as others have talked about, that as kind of a catchphrase, to me means, on some most basic level, what in my mind is kind of an unavoidable conclusion, which is that halakha and mitzvot care about something happening in the world. They actually matter. The performance of a given mitzvah actually encodes some value, some desired outcome that we want to see play out. And halakha, therefore, is not just about obedience. To the extent that halakha as values is very important to me, it is because a mantra of talking about halakha as being about nothing more than obedience, to me, basically eviscerates all meaning or purpose or worth behind it, and essentially eviscerates the voice of the mitzvah, the commander that stands behind it, which maybe we'll get back to. I think the pasuk that speaks most deeply to me and has spoken to others over the generations, the Rambam, the Dor Revi'i, Rav Moshe Glasner, and others, is in Dvarim, Ushmartem v'asitem, ki hi chochmatchem uvinatchem le'inei ha'amim, asher yishmu net kol ha'dvarim ha'ele v'yomru, rak am chacham v'navon ha'goy ha'gadol hazeh. The idea that the story the Torah tells about itself is something where the nations of the world, the outsiders to Torah, come and see people fulfilling the mitzvot, and they think that seems like an incredible way to live one's life. If halakha is nothing more than, in a disciplined, regular fashion, reading the phone book, to take Yeshayahu Leibovitz's kind of counterexample of how we might think about this, that sentence actually makes no sense. So that's the sense in which I'm deeply committed to the idea that mitzvot matter, and they are encoding values and purpose in the world. What it does not mean, and I've often been surprised to hear people think it means, are a couple things. One, halakha as values, being committed to the idea that halakha stands for something, doesn't mean that halakha is nothing more than one arbitrary set of preferences and values among a potentially infinite number and a potentially sort of infinitely varied idiosyncratic number of value systems that someone might bring to the table. Meaning halakha's values doesn't mean, well, everyone's striving for some kind of truth and some kind of meaning and purpose, and this is what the Trumat HaDeshen and the Rambam happen to think, but this is what I think. Right? There's a significant gap, I think, between what it means to say that something means something and it means whatever I want it to mean or whatever I feel like it should mean. And in that sense, that is where I think actually, maybe we'll come back to this too, the practice of Talmud Torah is so central. Because what halakha's values means to me is that the deep act of learning means I am encountering things that are not what I already think. They're not what I already have decided are my values, and all I'm looking for are the transcendent language and expressions for that. I'm actually learning. I'm actually changing my own position and my own stances on that. So that's what I would say. We can sort of come back to it, but it stands for something and it means something, but that doesn't mean it just means whatever I want it to mean.
Okay, so maybe I'll ask you another question coming at this perhaps with a little bit of a tangent. And I realize you could turn this question around on me, and if you do, it's fair game. But why do you trust your moral intuition so much? So much of what you do as a posek.
Okay, go ahead. Great.
So much of what you do as a posek assumes that your moral intuitions, the moral intuitions of your students, have enormous weight. I could make a theological argument that that's a posture of arrogance. Why is it not that?
So, two things on this. The first is, I think, what, you know, in Chazal's language, to take their words themselves on this, imeinam nevi'im b'nei nevi'im him. The idea, the claim that is made really throughout the language and culture of Psak, I would say, right, imeinam nevi'im b'nei nevi'im him is somehow to be translated of, even if their intuitions are not exactly right, they are derivative of very important and solid intuitions. That is to say, what Nevi'ut is about is on some level tapping into some deeper transcendent truth that expresses something of what God wants in the world. Now that is a shocking statement, right? Imeinam Nevi'im b'nei Nevi'im him, but it is decidedly a solidly rabbinic statement. And in that sense, I see all of us as trying to find a way to continue in that masoret of taking people's religious intuitions of what it is that God wants of us seriously. Not that those are then the end point of the conversation, but they have to be reckoned with. They have to either be translated into halachic language, or I have to somehow figure out how maybe that intuition is off. We can come back to that. I don't think we... Right, there's a difference between trusting your intuition as having something of value to say and assuming that your intuition is in no need of refinement or correction. And I think that's true of any conversation, right? I don't have to agree with everything that someone I'm talking to says in order to respect and value everything that they say and feel responsible to integrate it. Now that said, I think there is a big difference here between what that statement is getting at, which I think is about kind of respect for the superego, as opposed to what it can mean in its more monstrous form, which is essentially simply to collapse in front of the desires of the id. Right? The idea that imeinam nevi'im him, translating that as, well, anything that they really want, or anything that a human being really wants really badly, is by definition in some way, at least directly or indirectly, the word of God. That's off, right? That's lo taturu acharei levavchem v'acharei einechem, which I think you have to take very seriously as a sort of counterpole in the conversation. But to quote Robert Cover, something he wrote many, many years ago, even a fourth grader knows the difference between do whatever you feel like doing and do what you think is right. Right? Those are two different statements. And opening up the kind of honest engagement with the moral judgment and religious intuitions that we bring to the table with the hearts and minds that God gave us, I don't think opens up the floodgates to collapsing in the face of desire.
So are there issues in which we end up, are there issues where we end up irreducibly in the place where what I feel is right and what I can legitimate halachically can't be bridged? Is there anything halacha can't be made to say? You speak about halacha as language. Is the language infinitely expansive, elastic?
So I would say, if I were to be glib, I would say something like, when you talk about a halachic problem, either it can be solved or it's not a problem. Let me try to unpack that a little. I think one of the key claims, if you are committed to a Torah that wants to actually instantiate goodness and purpose and God's will in the world, and you are committed to the notion of a God who is a loving and covenantal and caring partner for Am Yisrael in this world, it simply can never be that there is a gap between your moral convictions, your moral and religious convictions, and Ritzon HaBorei, what it is that God wants of you. Something is off. If you feel that gap between those two, one of two things has to change. Either your intuition, and this goes to sort of the limits on the trust of the intuition, right? You may sort of initially respect an intuition. Sometimes intuitions are wrong. Right? Anyone who's ever seen the Big Lebowski knows the character of Walter. It's the best instantiation of that important point. There are sometimes intuitions that actually need to be cross-examined. And part of the act of learning, I would say, is when you learn halacha, when you learn Torah, when you learn about mitzvot, you are cross-examining your intuitions. And in that sense, sometimes there is a gap between where you are in terms of what you think is right and what you understand halacha to say to you, or actually what you understand to be right has not been correct. And the act of learning will persuade you that that is not the case. And that's the sense in which, right, the side of my sort of initial statement, it's actually not a problem. What appeared to be a problem to you was the product of the fact that you did not actually correctly understand until you learned this text, until you encountered this idea, what God actually really wants of you in this situation. I mean, Mitzad Sheni, on the other hand, there's no question that there are times where the problem is solvable because what has not happened yet in the process is you have not given enough credit or spent enough time with the halachic material, with the literature on mitzvot, to actually play out all of its subtleties and all of its nuance. And in that sense, I think, you know, the religious goal I feel very confident describing as the zeroing out of the gap between what feels like the right thing to do and what I understand halacha or mitzvot, God, to demand of me. But I don't think that means one simply reduces into the other. I think the real serious process of Talmud Torah is one in which you are actually prepared to jettison things that you took for granted before you started learning. And if you never change anything that you thought beforehand when you're learning, I would say you haven't learned. And part of that process is also, through deep learning, recognizing that sometimes you just haven't discovered that voice that actually says what you're looking for.
Okay, so I want to ask you one more question, then we'll take maybe a round from the audience. And this is maybe going to be an aggressive-sounding question. So 99.5% of the people in the world who care about halakha and see it as authoritative in their life think that women can count in a minyan. You say they can. What does it mean for you to look out on the world and be like a dramatic dat yachid? To be a voice in the wilderness on this question, what gives you the authority to take that stand in the face of everybody else?
Right. Yeah, I think about that question a lot.
We've never talked about it before.
more than I'd like to think about it. Look, I try to divide things up into a couple of categories on this. First of all, look, sometimes there are things where you're right and other people are wrong. Okay? I think it's actually important to put that out there, which is going to be like the 10% of my answer, and then we'll get to the 90%. But there are some things where, in fact, yeah, there can be myths that are out there in the world. I think we're all familiar with this with all kinds of areas of life that need to be dispelled, right? Someone that wants to claim that the normative line of rabbinic thinking on obligation in daily tefillah vis-a-vis men and women is gendered is wrong. They're just wrong. It's plain from the Mishnah all the way through the Shulchan Aruch, and only when you get to the Magen Avraham do you get any complexity around that question. And there is actually an aspect of what it means to be committed to an idea to try to locate those pieces, I think, where you say, it's not that people are wrong in the sense that they're bad people. It's not, I walk around with all kinds of conventional things that I assume in my life as an American citizen, as a global citizen, as a Jew, that I haven't investigated, I haven't paid attention to the details, they don't fit the conventional patterns of my life, and we rely on people to sometimes come along and dispel those myths. Now that said, though, yeah, I could be wrong. Right? I could be really wrong. And I think for me that has always translated into recognizing that there is a major element of what it means to be quote-unquote right that is not about ultimately whether in your eyes you're right and everyone else is wrong, but really have you translated that into something real on the ground that on some level forces itself to be taken seriously as something that ultimately potentially is recognized as right. In that sense, writing a tshuva about how women can be justified counting in a minyan is, of course, one piece, right? And that's a central piece. But an equally, if not more important piece, is we somehow lay the groundwork for a world in which, in an airport, you may be pulled over to an egalitarian minyan. Right? And actually, until you've really created the conditions where the latter is true and just sort of a self-evident part of the fabric of observant Jewish life, I'm not sure how much the first adds up to, even if it's sort of an important prerequisite. And in that sense, I take that charge, and I think everyone should take that charge very seriously, that what it means to be a da'at yachid is to have kind of serious doubt about where you are holding with that, but it doesn't necessarily translate into backing off of the rightness of that view. It may just sort of put more pressure on you and on those who you sort of persuade to be on board to actually build something that makes that real. Now the other thing, though, which I think is on some level the most important for thinking about and talking about this like within the language of halakha, is, to put it in its most trite way, but then to unpack it a bit, I don't have to think someone else is wrong to think I'm right. In that sense, one of the most important distinctions between codes and responsa is that codes fundamentally, by their nature, make decisions about what answers to questions are in the abstract and implicitly say that anyone that takes a different position in the abstract is wrong, is in machloket, somehow stands in tension. A sheila u'tshuva, a responsum that goes back and forth between a questioner and a respondent, actually says nothing more than, you've presented me with a set of facts, I'm telling you what my understanding is of the translation of those facts. In that sense, I actually don't feel the need to say that all kinds of people in the Jewish world who do not have a gender-blind minyan are necessarily completely wrong on filtering the facts as they see them in their circumstances. Now, maybe I would. If I were kind of confronted with that, maybe I would reach a different conclusion. But I think another important way of balancing that tension is we are only alone in our views to the extent that we already actually presuppose that everyone shares all the same data points of life as me and is thereby reaching a different conclusion. I actually think there's a deep way in which you're really open to the ways in which halakha essentially filters the experience of life through Torah, that you can actually see yourself as a total partner and comrade of someone because they have a different life filter, has reached some kind of different conclusion.
Why don't we take two questions from the floor that you can respond to them? Can't see you, but yes, please. Oh, Rabbi Diamond, sorry. Can't see you at all.
Rabbi Tupper, you have dealt with the issue of conflict between what a person's intuitions might be and what the halakha might say. I would say, you haven't talked about it on the experiential thing. And I want to take a very concrete case, which is the case of gays being able or not being able to have a sexual relationship. I can accept that after careful study, one concludes that even though my intuition is that this is something that should be possible, the Torah tells me that it's not. The part that you haven't addressed, which I think needs to be addressed in some way, is that I think it's hard to avoid the conclusion that that's cruel. I mean, it's cruel to say to somebody, you cannot have basic human experience, as far as the Torah is concerned, that other people can have. I'm not saying that that has to change the halakha, but I just be interested in hearing how you factor that in.
Let's take one other question, since that was
who wants to be hard. Paired with that question.
Ask the hard one. Come on.
I have a very different question. If you weren't doing this, what would you be doing?
Well,
that's a good one. Okay, let's start with the first one. That's the first one's the easy question.
There is something else.
So, look, that's always the elephant in the room in these conversations, in the contemporary conversation. So let me try to kind of filter that question through what I was talking about in a more direct way. I'll say it first sort of in the negative formulation and then in the positive. I take a dim view of an approach to homosexuality that says, I feel your pain, I understand how much you suffer as a result of feeling denied this basic human experience by the Torah, but what can I do? The Torah says, and usually the person themselves will not say this, but they will essentially be saying some version of, the Torah says I must oppress you. That to me violates kind of everything about what the enterprise of Torah is supposed to be about and what the enterprise of translating psak to an individual human being is supposed to be about. Now, that said, and here I'll sort of talk kind of a little more theoretically, what I think that approach is about, the biggest problem with that approach is it demonstrates actual complete and total alienation from the Torah. Right? That is to say, I know the Torah says this, I feel this way, and then, quite frankly, that can play out in one of two ways. Right? A person can then respond and say, I must oppress you in the name of the Torah. Or they will say, because I can't bear to oppress you, I have to throw out Vayikra Yudchet. Right? But it's actually those two positions, which lead to two totally radically different policy positions, are the same thing. Both of those people completely agree that they are totally alienated from the substance of what the Torah has to say about this. They are just picking winners and losers as to whether this pasuk wins or this person wins. Right? That to me is sort of the whole problem with how much of halakha is addressed around that issue today. I think you have to push yourself again. Ushmartem vasitem ki hi chokhmatchem uvinatchem. If you want this to be an enterprise of wisdom that can be admired from the outside, you have one of two things that you can do, both of which I think have integrity. One is to have a conversation with that person and with yourself and with the Torah that essentially comes to the conclusion that in fact, homosexuality is a bad and destructive thing. And you don't understand it yet, but I've come to appreciate what the Torah has to say about this, and I am going to try to persuade you. Whether or not I do persuade you, I'm not going to feel bad about persuading you because I've actually come, and this goes to halakha's values, right? I've actually come to understand, internalize, and respect the value that is being coded there. Right? And then we could spell out what that looks like in that particular case. You could come up with any number of things, be satisfied to some people in the room, be totally unsatisfying to many other people in the room. But there would be an integrity and an identification with Torah by having that response, and ideally that would actually engender a loving, caring conversation with that person because you don't want to just repress them, you actually want to somehow bring them to that place. Or alternatively, right, to the extent that I never got that conversation off the ground because I was never able to get that far with Vayikra Yudchet, or more to the point, in the course of actually trying to have that conversation with that person, I realized all I was doing was inflicting a different kind of pain in a way that was not enabling me to sleep at night. Well, then on some level, it can't be that that's what Vayikra Yudchet means. And in that sense, I feel very strongly about this. Halakha does not change. Halakha does not change. Halakha and mitzvot are eternal. They are as eternal as a light bulb that was lit from the first 6 days of creation and burns until the present day. But what does change is, if I put a red lens in front of that light, I suddenly have people slamming on the brakes to stop, and I put a green lens in front of that light, and I suddenly have people slamming on the gas pedal to go forward. And it's the filter through which those eternal mitzvot are filtered that makes all the difference. And there, I think there's a lot of questions and a lot of ways of talking about what that pasuk means. Does that pasuk apply to gay people in the same way it applies to straight people? What do we learn about the models of left-handedness and right-handedness in halakha as ways of dealing with different subunits of the population that may have the same exact mitzvah to put tefillin on their dominant arm, but it turns out that because God creates people with some variety, actually the dominant arm is not always the same for everyone. Right? Now, I'm not claiming that to say we've snapped our fingers, we've addressed that problem, or even, actually for the purposes of this question, right, which is sort of about how does this dynamic play out, I don't even want to take a stance on that, because to me, the halachic world would be much healthier if everyone were situated similarly in a stance of identification with the Torah, even if then there were vitriolic debates as to what the right thing is to do. I think the stance that valorizes the alienation of, I don't understand this value, but the Torah says, and therefore I'm bound to enforce it no matter what, even in a case where I feel I am essentially doing harm in a destructive way to a human being, that to me is the enemy, much more than predetermining what the right conclusion is. On the second piece, I really had to think about it more. I mean, I was going to go to law school. That was the plan. But
when we were kids, everybody did.
Exactly. Too many hours of L.A. law in my youth. Let's put it this way. I'm not sure I imagined always that I would be either doing this professionally or, more to the point necessarily, had you asked me, would you be up here being some like point person for how people are thinking and talking about halakha? That is not something I necessarily would have imagined, that that's where I would be. I think I have, you know, for a long time it's been centrally important to me, both personally and professionally, to try to somehow change and affect various things on the ground. And in that sense, I think part of what's always been powerful to me about the language of halakha, and I got sort of more and more sucked into it in terms of my religious and teaching life, has been it's a very powerful, pragmatic language for what does Jewish life look like on the ground. And I think whatever I was doing, I would be involved in figuring out how those pragmatics play out.
So permit me just because I'm curious. If you, then I just want to ask a slightly different question, but very much similar. Do you sometimes think that if you were raised Christian or Muslim, that you would, within that system, also, you know...
I would be an altar boy without any question. And I don't just say that as a joke. I actually think that is true. Right? That is 100% true. And we could do all this sort of psychologizing of what kinds of people fit into that mode, etc. And that's a whole other interesting conversation that I've sort of grappled with. Of, you know, there seem to be people in the world that have antinomian personalities, right? And what does that mean, and how deeply, and I don't feel I have any expertise on that, but it's something I've sort of grappled with. How do you articulate reasonable, right? Part of what's powerful about halakha is it has these universal democratic expectations. It doesn't just say, anyone to whom this speaks, do it. It's everyone who's in the brit is part of that. What if there's sort of a dynamic, though, around the details of things that doesn't fall totally equally on every person? Yeah, it's a great question.
So let me ask you maybe one more question in closing this section. Who are your models for what Psak Halakha should look like? And maybe derivatively of that, just briefly, what characteristics should a Posek have? What kind of person is she?
So I'll give two quick examples of Posekim that I've thought about as role models and try to give actually very specific ways. The first is Rav Ovadia Yosef. And there's two things that I've always admired about Rav Ovadia. And it's not most of the things that show up on the CNN fringe feed. There's two things. One, he's simply staggering beyond all belief, bekivut. And I think that's always spoken to me in terms of if Talmud Torah is to be something that is more than just finding the sources that already speak to what I'm already committed to, bekiyut actually becomes a spiritual practice beyond just the acquisition of knowledge, because what you're saying is I want to look everywhere and kind of see everything to see how that might affect me. And to see a posek who just plays that out. He just kind of knows everything. Like, you can sort of take your pick. If Rabbi Avadia has written a tshuva, you can look it up in the Encyclopedia Talmudit, or you can look at the Abiya Omer, and you'll get all the same sources because he's collected it all. That's one thing. The other thing that Rabbi Avadia does, which I think he gets a bad rap for, and I don't even know, like maybe he would be horrified hearing me describe it this way, but I take inspiration from it. His use of sfeik sfeika, and I'll play this out just for a minute. Yeah. Sfeik sfeika is a concept that appears in the Talmud, which more or less engages the notion that when you have two axes of doubt with respect to a given prohibition, you don't have to worry about the prohibition being in play. So for instance, I might say like whether I can eat a certain food, right? I might have one safek as to whether this piece of meat in front of me was in fact slaughtered in a proper fashion or not. And even if it wasn't slaughtered in a proper fashion, maybe now it's been so dried out and altered from its original state that it would also be permitted to eat it. Right, and therefore, since I have these sort of two axes of doubt, I can almost say I've fallen below the 50% threshold of statistical probability that I have a problem. And via this principle of sfeik sfeika, two axes of doubt, I can permit. But there's sort of a whole tradition in Psak to also do this with respect to not kind of statistical, physical doubt about the facts of the case, but about the epistemological doubt of whether a given halachic opinion is right or not. In other words, if I can sort of point to two major debates in the history of halacha, where in my given circumstance, people split, asur mutar, permitted, forbidden, such that I can draw out a kind of decision tree where three of the outcomes will come out as permitted, and one of them will forbid, I'm allowed to essentially say, well, then via sfeik sfeika, this is permitted. Now, Rav Avadia does this all the time, but what I draw inspiration from of it is the way he uses it often is to rebalance the halachic playing field. He's often doing it for sort of almost nationalist Sfaradi versus Ashkenazi hegemony reasons, but he'll sort of take a picture of a convention of a halachic practice that has come into play, and he'll say, well, wait a minute, we're actually, if we pay attention to the full picture of all the positions on this, hanging out on the machmir twig of the stringent branch of the right side of the tree. And when we actually look at the picture of the whole tree with all of its branches, we could actually still be in a very conservative position being right in the middle above the trunk. And that idea of what it means to use that bikiyut to potentially kind of recenter the conversation from time to time is something I find very moving and inspirational. The other I'll just mention briefly, and maybe we can come back to more concrete, but Rav Shlomo Goren, former chief rabbi, Ashkenazi chief rabbi of the state, is another example of someone who what I always get from everything I've seen of Rav Goren is on display this incredibly passionate conviction that halacha has to work. It somehow has to play out in a way that is going to be functional. For him, that was particularly anchored around taking responsibility for halacha in the state of Israel. How do we figure out how we have medical schools that could have kohanim be part of them? And how, even though they're going to come in contact with the dead as part of their medical training? And any number of other examples where that to me is also sort of the attitude, even more than the results, is something I try to hold very close, which is the idea that you actually have a responsibility to make this halakha, this law, make sense for people and work in the world. Now we get to switch it up? All right. So I'm
now going to offer Psak halakha that you've always been waiting for.
So I didn't quite get to your last question, and you can the last element of your question of what should a postdoc be like? What should their character traits be? And you can throw that back at me if you want, but let me reflect it back at you when we think about now sort of shifting the main focus of the conversation to theology, theological language, God, and the presence of God in our lives and in Jewish community. Theology, I think, in many quarters can run the risk of being a highly philosophical enterprise, a very detached enterprise. And yet for you, it is clearly so bound up in what kind of human being you should be and how you should play that out. What kind of person is a theologian supposed to be? And are they supposed to be a different person than just your average, perhaps less theologically sophisticated Jew?
If you listen closely, you can hear the voice of God. Next question. So, what kind of person is a theologian supposed to be? I guess a lot of thoughts about this. I'll share maybe just a couple. The first is the most obvious one. I think a theologian, to be a real theologian, has to begin from a place of humility, realizing that we, flesh and blood, mortal, limited, petty, jealous, having shortness of vision, are trying, stammeringly, to talk about something transcendent and utterly beyond speech. It reminds me of what Rabbi Louis Jacobs used to say, that sometimes when he talks to theologians, he gets the impression they had just had lunch with God. And I think it's very important to avoid ever talking that way. That's the first piece. The second piece is, I think, if you want to do theology, if you want to be a student of theology, let alone a teacher of theology, one of the central projects of your life is to grow in compassion. As Midrash Sifrei famously puts it, Ritzoncha lehakir et mi she'amar v'haya olam, right? Is it your desire to know the one who spoke and the world came into being? Lemod Agadah, study, I never know how to translate Agadah, here I'm going to render it as narrative and theology. Shemitoch kach, because through that, atava lehakir et mi she'amar v'haya olam, you will come to know the one who spoke the world into being, u'midabek bidrachav, and cleave to God's ways, which in rabbinic tradition means usually one thing, compassion and presence for those who are vulnerable and suffering. And that midrash, as I often say in this day, midrash, is shocking, because it wasn't the question. The question was, do you want to know God? And the answer is, you want to know God, learn Agadah, because through that you'll know God. And then Chazal, right, can't help themselves, because what is the point and the ultimate destination of learning theology? Umida beit bidrachav. To do theology is to be on the path towards a more compassionate life that reflects divine compassion. Otherwise, what you're doing is Wissenschaft, is Jewish studies, maybe even is enough to get you tenure in the philosophy department, but is not Jewish theology. Another characteristic of a theologian, and I worry about sounding like a parody of myself, but to be a theologian, you have to worry a lot. And one of the things you have to worry about is, one of my great anxieties in life is that I feel like very often religion makes good people better and bad people worse. Mm-hmm. And the question of what it means to take responsibility for putting forward religious ideas in the world. In the age of Al-Qaeda, in the age of so much religiously motivated brutality, is an enormous responsibility. Religion can be an enormous brake, B-R-A-K-E, on our most violent, hateful impulses, and it can stoke the embers like nothing else. And to be a theologian is to actually not just worry about that, but to try and take responsibility for that. And the last thing I'll say, just to sort of balance that a little, which is maybe a little more surprising, I think to be a theologian, you need to have a sense of humor. Because, first of all, to be a flesh and blood mortal talking about something transcendent, you should always be conscious of the fact that what you're doing is somewhat ridiculous. It's holy, it's important, and yet there's something ridiculous about the presumption. And also, what it means to worship a transcendent God is to know that God is ultimate and nothing else is, and least of all you. Which means you have to be able to laugh at yourself. I mean, as Rabbinic Agadah likes to say, right,
God says, I cannot dwell in the same place as someone arrogant. And the best antidote to arrogance is simply the capacity to laugh at yourself.
So let me ask a kind of tough following up question to that, because essentially, right, you're laying out a case for, particularly I think with that Sifrei, you want to know God, learn Agadah, and God is clearly sort of in your description, the central and primary player in the dynamic of Jewish life. And two comments that are questions on that. One of the things that I think distinguishes a lot of contemporary Jews is that they actually speak with great pride about the ways in which it's great to be Jewish because you don't have to believe anything, and we don't have dogmas, etc. And a question that comes in the same vein from what we're studying right here in the yeshiva right now, which is Hilchot Giyur, the laws of conversion. And it's very striking there because you have a text, right? I mean, the text around the conversion ceremony is essentially a window into the rabbinic leadership's chance to construct a Jew from scratch. And when they are engaged in that building project, they talk about circumcision. They talk about going in a body of water. They talk about telling the person about a range of mitzvot, and there is nothing about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, nothing about dogmas, nothing about anything, and this is actually what's ferrying people across the channel from being a Gentile to a Jew. And obviously, you know, the Rambam feels this so powerfully that he puts it into his rendering of it, but that only makes the absence more powerful. What do you make of that? Where is God for Chazal in that text?
It's a really interesting question. I will defer the factual answer, if there is one, to the historians. I'll tell you just a couple of reflections about it. One is,
possibility one is, God is so real for Chazal that God is implicitly there anytime you have a conversation about halacha. Now, the danger is what happens over time when assuming that God is implicit ends up meaning that God becomes suppressed. Right? I don't think that's a good reading of Chazal, but I think it's a good reading of the danger of the ways that God can become a kind of muted, under-the-surface voice, is that what becomes implicit can all too often become forgotten. Something about which the Rambam spent basically every day of his life screaming his head off. Now, another way of thinking about this maybe is, you know, what comes to mind to me is, I think it's in Psalm 119, but I might be wrong about this, there is a verse that is shocking. The psalmist says, Va'esa kapai al mitzvotecha. I will raise my hands in prayer to your mitzvot. Like, swallow hard when you read that. After all, what does Eicha say? Siyei lav kapayich, right? Raise your hands in prayer to God. So the sort of crude reading of Tehillim there is that they're turning mitzvot into an idol. The more generous and I think more accurate reading of Tehillim is, so convinced is the psalmist of the a kind of inextricable link between mitzvot and God's presence, that at moments you can almost turn to the mitzvot as the most powerful vehicle in the world to God. Now, the danger of that is what happens in a world like ours, where even so many people who think of themselves as very religious actually don't have a God language at all. I mean, we live in a profoundly atheological age, and I'd like to say that is at least as true in Orthodoxy as it is everywhere else. And so what happens in a world where, rather than halakha being a means to, halakha itself becomes a kind of idol. It reminds me of perhaps the most famous slur Hasidim used to tell about Mishnagdim. Okay, it's totally unfair, but it's sort of powerful. Hasidim very often said, what is the difference between a chassid and a misnagid? What's the difference between a chassid and... you should never translate misnagid as an opponent of chassidism because it robs them of their own identity, but for now we'll say that. The answer to chassidim used to say is, chassid is a yirei shamayim. Chassid fears God. Misnagid is a yirei shulchan aruch. Misnagid is afraid of the shulchan aruch. That's what happens to the Hasidim, we're saying, when Va'esaka Pael Mitzvotecha is because the mitzvot are God, as opposed to inextricably tied up to God. Now, the last thing I would say about this is, and this is really the other pole of Chazal, something that my teacher, Yitz Greenberg, likes to say, which I think is enormously interesting and powerful. He says, you know, one of the crises that faced rabbinic Judaism in the first century and thereafter is that just as Jews were beginning to tell a story about God hiding God's face and stepping back and removing God's self from the world, Christians came along and told a story that said, oh, really? Because God just showed up and walked around a few years ago. And Chazal were stuck with this unbelievable sense of the tragic. How do we not abandon the reality of the covenant, our utter unbreakable faith in an eternal covenant, in the face of a world in which God's presence is not manifest? And after the destruction of the Second Temple, right, they're really not sure what they did wrong. And that is a very powerful question. So, you know, is it that God is so present, you know, where I started, that God is so present, that God is implicitly there in the moment, or that there is an expression of tragedy in that discourse? But one thing I think there isn't, right, is a sense of, oh, God is irrelevant. It reminds me of something Heschel says in passing. He says, you know, some Jews like to say, they quote the notion that since the destruction of the temple, God doesn't have anything but the four amot of halakha. He says, most of those people never point out that that's a lament. That's something Chazal are heartbroken about. It's not a lechachila argument for the doing away with theology.
So let me just follow up on that, because you already alluded to how difficult it can be to be God intoxicated in an increasingly atheological age. So what's then the call of the moment in that regard? Meaning, it sounds like you're not content to say, I mean, tell me if I heard this right, it sounds like, well, maybe in Chazal's world, you could entertain the notion that God is so present that they don't need to talk about it. What if someone said that to you about, you know, what if I said to you, well, yeah, like I grew up and read Tanakh and like dove into God and it's sort of just there, it's obvious, but I don't need to consciously talk about it always for it to be there. Would you sort of allow for that? Is that a stable expression of theological commitment in the contemporary world? Or would you say, no, that's actually dangerous, because our world is such that, as you put it, the silence turns into some kind of suppression?
So I think it's a difficult question, but I think what I would say first is, if you want to once in a while pray and not just daven, you have to figure out what it means to be in the presence of God, or what it means to strive to be in the presence of God. Because otherwise, you are on the road towards the Siddur, for example, being a phone book. Right? Because if you want to say the word Atah, and to me that's a basic kind of actual criterion for Jewish theology, if the way you talk about God can't generate a meaningful way of saying the word you, there is something fundamentally broken about the Jewishness of your theology. But if you want to say you, you got to know about who you're talking about. It would be almost like saying, I mean, I spent 15 years with my wife. I love her. I don't need to, like, really think about her all that much. Right? There's something, right? In other words, if you want to actually talk about a covenant, in other words, let's put it this way. If we mean the words we say in our learning, in our praying, we have to think about God. And does everyone have to spend all day thinking about God? No, but I think if you want to be religious and an inheritor of this tradition and its discourse, as more than just stuff that you mouth, you have to engage the question. I put it in a slightly different way. Something I say, you know, when I'm asked, you know, you have to believe in God to be a good Jew. So, you know, in a way I would be agnostic in certain ways about that question, but what I would say is, if you want to really inherit the conversation of the Jewish people, you have to wrestle with the fact that in not wrestling with God, you're leaving out the main character of the story. And that's an enormously big choice. And I would also ask the question, what might be sustainable for individuals is very unlikely to sustain a community, let alone a community that thinks of itself as partners in an eternal covenant. Maybe that's why that language has become so stripped away and so thin in our Jewish society.
So you're part of this growing, increasing atheological age also. Do you ever feel yourself aligned with the doubters, and how do you deal with that?
Can someone get me another pitcher of water? The older I get, the more aligned I am with them every day. But I would say a couple of things about this, about the role of doubt in theology. First of all, I'm not convinced that one can have a mature faith without a robust sense of doubt. And I want to say that in a couple of ways. First of all, it was the great philosopher Soren Kierkegaard who said something that I think is just unbelievably powerful, liberating, and slightly terrifying. Now, I'm going to a little bit, you know, spin what he says, but it's more or less accurate. He says, you know, if meaningful philosophers had succeeded in proving the existence of God, they would have destroyed the possibility of anyone being religious. Because if you know something, you can't have faith in it. Because by definition, faith involves risk. Faith involves risk. Or as he puts it, you're standing out over an ocean with not that much below you. And you could be wrong. You could be wrong with a capital W. You could be staking your life on what ultimately, if I were still in the world about analytic philosophy, I would say, I'm not just worried about being wrong, I'm worried about speaking nonsense. Right? You could be just totally wrong. You could risk your life and be totally wrong. That's what it means to have faith. Faith is to take a risk. So one of the things I often think about is modernity allows us a new possibility to deepen our faith. Because anyone who is alive in the modern world and never has a doubt has a vision problem. Because they haven't walked around in the streets of New York City. If you are completely confident, without any question at all, and I'm talking about like, as I would like to say, God, right? You believe in a God who created the world and loves people. And you never doubt that? Okay. Then your theology is actually purchased by closing your eyes. And I don't know that that's a virtue. So, you know, I think part of what it means to be a believer is to hold at the same time a theological conviction and a willingness to stare in the face realities that seem to controvert it and at times make it seem ridiculous. So that's like the first piece. That's what enables faith. The other thing I would say is I think the role of a theologian completely changes when you take seriously doubt. I'll say it in this way. I am totally opposed to those forms of kiruv that fundamentally emerge from a place of condescension. I have the truth, and you, poor Tinokshin Ishva, poor kidnapped child, I will convey that truth to you and enable you to return to the true path. I'm not that sure of myself. And frankly, I think I have a tremendous amount to learn from secularity of various kinds, even though I think there are all kinds of things that are impoverished about secularity. So I think, you know, one of the things that doubt does is A, deepen the possibility of faith, and B, require whole different level of humility. It's not just about standing in superiority over people who don't share your fundamental intuitions about the world. There's a lot more to say about that.
Let's take a couple questions, maybe two or three for this segment, and then we'll move on. Yes, please.
What we've seen post-Holocaust, contrary to all expectations outside the walls of Hadar, is a great turning to the right, because Halakha becoming more rigid, how would you explain this theologically? To mask down, to justify God? What's happening?
This is a variety of a question I always ask, but this seems a good time to ask it directly. Which is, what is your response to a person who says, I have no faith? I don't feel it. I don't feel this supernatural presence of which you speak. How does one live one life according to these precepts without?
One more?
I guess building off of that also, is it possible to see oneself as a member of that covenantal community as a community, but as an individual be wrestling too much with the doubt to not see oneself as individually a part of that covenant? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I know these softball questions. How do I explain the turn to the right? Well,
after the Holocaust.
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting. It's actually interesting that I kind of unconsciously dropped the phrase after the Holocaust. I think one of the interesting questions is that on this issue, Jews are not alone. Right? This is an international religious phenomenon. And also one thing about modernity. I think one of the things that modernity does, in fact, some sociologists essentially define modernity as the collapse of everything that was ever self-evident. Nothing is self-evident anymore. And I think one of the things that you have in the turn to the right in religions all over the world is an insistent attempt to reclaim self-evidence, which, by the way, doesn't work, which is why a word I really can't stand, because I think it basically means just religions that I don't like, but why fundamentalist movements are so irreducibly modern, because they are about responses to the things that modernity has shaken up. It's not so coincidental, by the way, that in almost all fundamentalist movements, there's a preoccupation with gender. Because gender, more than anything in the world, in a certain way, is the thing that has become least self-evident. So that's a piece about religions in the world. Now, in terms of the Shoah, this really goes to something I was saying earlier, I think, in my response to Ethan, which is, you know, in a world in which people find it harder and harder to talk about God, halakha can become a kind of substitute. The danger, of course, is that there is no corrective at that point. Meaning, let's put it this way, formalistic halakha has no corrective if you're not thinking about, wait a second, I'm worshiping a God of love and compassion, El Rachum V'Chanun. Right? One of the things I often find interesting, and this really dovetails with something that he was saying earlier, is that I think many rabbis and poskim have simply abandoned thinking about the fact that every time you answer a halachic question, you are implicitly making a statement about the kind of God you worship. And the depth of the atheological nature of a lot of psakis, you never hear people talk about that. I mean, I always say I would welcome a modern Orthodox posik to get up and say the following sentence. I don't know how to solve the question of homosexuality, but I want you to know that I will never sleep again because I don't know how the same God could say it is not good for a human being to be alone and then set up a system where some people are mandated for all eternity to be alone. And I will not make an akidah out of other people's suffering because I will believe in that God. That's a religious posture. It's not satisfactory, ultimately, but that's a religious posture. But I think that there's, you know, an awful lot going on there. You know, one of the things that's interesting is people often talk about how post-Holocaust theology as a movement ended. But I don't think we should be confused and think that that's because the questions went away. I think in some ways it's because the questions won. And that's very deep. We are, you know, on so many levels as a people, still utterly traumatized. Metaphysically and in every other way. If you don't think Jews are still traumatized by the Holocaust, I invite you to read the comment section on any Jewish magazine or website. Right? You will rarely get more than 3 comments in before someone calls someone a Nazi. Right? This is a people in profound need of some kind of collective therapy, and it's not just metaphysical, it's also political, it's also ethical, it's also interpersonal. So that is of a piece of a much larger... In other words, yes, the turn to the right is an international religious phenomenon, and as somebody once said, Jews are like everyone else, only more so. Right? So, you know, Jews are particularly skilled at that. Now, the next question. Eric's question. So, here's what I would not say.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, the question is, someone says, I just don't have faith.
In a supernatural God.
Let's not embellish Eric's point. Okay?
You know, there are 2 kinds of doing theology. One is, what, this term is not helpful because it's kind of idiosyncratically used, but what is sometimes called apologetic theology. That is, I try to make an argument to convince you of something. Then there's another form of theology which we could call confessional theology, which is that I try to describe what the world looks like from within a certain lens and invite you to try it on. I am totally committed to the second project. By the way, it's interesting that Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik was a total, great embodiment of the second who had no interest in the first, as far as I can tell. He is completely unengaged in the project of convincing people, as opposed to someone like Heschel, who actually thinks he can convince people that deep down they really do believe. Soloveitchik is, in that very limited sense, a much more sort of liberal figure. Now, can someone live by the precepts? I think Judaism has always said, right, if you don't do mitzvot for the ideal reason of relationship with God, you should do them anyway. It holds out the hope that people will eventually come to faith. I think in the modern world we realize they may not. At the risk of digressing for one second, one of the things that has plagued religious Zionist thought from the beginning is that it has assumed almost across the board that secularity was a fleeting phenomenon. It was going to disappear very soon. It's one of the things, one of the many things that bedevils religious Zionist thought, is the inability to confront secularity is something that for the indefinite future is not going away.
And the third question, what was the third question?
Lily,
thank you. Can you be part of the community without being sure you're part of the covenant? Is that what you meant? I mean, descriptively, I would say an enormous percentage of the Jewish community does just that. And the theological ambulances are coming for us to face the consequences. You can. Again, see, I think there's two different questions here. One is, can a Jew participate in the fullness of Jewish life without being a believer? I think we see people do that. Now, from a theological perspective, is it really the fullest Jewish life? Probably not. But a Jew can do that, can be a full participant. The more interesting, I think, and difficult question is, can a community long endure without that discourse? The evidence is not promising. There's a lot you could say about that, but the evidence is not promising. You will almost never meet a liberal Jew, let alone a Jew who says, I don't believe in God, who has a grandchild, who is more or less where they are. How are you going to write on that point, by the way? They may be wrong about other things that do or don't follow from it, but they're right on that point. So I think the answer is yes, when you frame it in a very limited way, which is not insignificant, it's a real issue. But the broader question I think facing the Jewish community is, you know, can Torah and the Jewish community long endure if God is stripped away from that conversation? And I think the answer to that is no.
So we want to take in our last 25 minutes or so, now kind of open it to revisit both halves of this conversation with some of your questions, things to follow up either on kind of either of the halves individually, or also if there are sort of points you want to draw out that somehow come from the juxtaposition of the two that haven't been fully played out. So we'll take a round, we'll do maybe kind of four at a time a couple times. Yeah.
So this
Ethan's good. It's good.
This is more directed at you, but when you talked about, and this is also ties back to Shai's question about like, who are you to be opposing, right? Don't you have to be arrogant? You talked about how halacha hasn't changed. It's just the lens that you filter it through. Well, the problem is how do you create a standard, right? And I also think that dovetails on the Dachshund point also, which is, sure, that's lovely, but I don't want to walk out of here. I don't think you intend for me to walk out of here and say, well, each thinks that I need to filter this. I should go learn, filter it through my experience, and this is how I'm going to, you know, render a psak halakha for myself.
Yeah.
When you mentioned the Kierkegaard thought, it seemed like you were saying that, without any doubt, there would be no possibility for faith to exist. Otherwise, we would just know. But it seems like in that sense you're assuming that faith is something that we want or need to have. So wouldn't it be better if you could stand out over the giant ocean beneath you and know for sure that whatever it is that's holding you up is going to withhold you? It seems like faith is somehow something that you were looking smilingly towards.
What advice do each of you have for those of us who are engaged in the task of trying to develop leaders for a meaningful Jewish enterprise?
I know for me one of the most exciting things about Yeshiva Hadar is that it's a yeshiva in America, as opposed to many institutions in Israel, and you use that. I'm curious, A, for Shai, is there a theological calling to be an American Jew? You know, our counterparts in Israel seem to have a very strong theological calling. Is there one here as well? And for Stephen, I'd ask the same questions from a halachic lens. What if Israel presents a really exciting opportunity to renew halacha? What does America or American Jewry represent for renewing halacha? Or is this even ideal? Or is the Ramban right? And really, these both here are a fun game, and only in Israel they're real.
Right. Sorry? Yeah. So let me start with the last one, and then I'll loop back. I tried to have a brief exchange on that question with Rabbi Benny Lau in Jerusalem a little over a year ago, and I said it was interesting. I'm going to give the same answer here that I gave there, but I also want you to know that the answer was not well received there. And I don't know what to make of that, and that is sort of part of the question here. My answer was more or less this. Judaism is not geographically neutral. Eretz Yisrael is the center. Anyone who thinks otherwise about that is lying to themselves. And that's the way it's always been, and I cannot imagine that being another way. It is also the case that acknowledging that Eretz Yisrael is the center never meant until a certain group of people in Basel and elsewhere came along that entailed Shlilat HaGolah and denying the deep religious contributions of Jews everywhere else, and in fact that being an actual real part of what it means to be Jewishly created. I would say even the Ramban, with some notion that it's sort of fun and games in the diaspora, I don't think actually fun and games is right. I think he would talk about a Platonic ideal as opposed to something that's nonetheless a real manifestation of it in some ways, but yes, not with some full level. And I would say kind of in the spirit of that, two things. The first is, there are certain things that, you know, we speak about halakha, mitzvot, and more broadly Jewish life, you can't play out as a dispersed minority in a country that has a kind of secular general state of all its citizens' identity, where you don't have the same kinds of ancestral roots that go back to foundational sacred texts, etc. And certainly where you're not also responsible for armies and hospitals and all kinds of institutions of state, not just because you're involved in those in America as a Jew, but you don't own them as a Jew. You're just participating in them even though you are a Jew. And that allows you, and that goes back to my comments about Rav Goren, and part of what I think is powerful about Rav Goren as a posek is you see that powerful dimension of, to quote Rabbi David Hartman, halakha and the Jewish people taking responsibility for itself. And there's ways in which that only plays out in Israel, and I think it's important to actually acknowledge the ways in which the diaspora doesn't do that. On the other hand, and here's the other part of what I said that didn't go over well, I do believe that there are ways in which you are forced to translate Torah in the diaspora that in some ways actually lead to a fuller and deeper fulfillment of that pasuk I started with in Dvarim, ki hi chokhmatchem uvinatchem le'inei ha'amim. That the people, the nation of the world, the nations of the world who are not you, will see what you are doing and they will marvel at it. And sometimes Israel has a kind of, lockdown echo chamber quality in that way, where it's Jews talking to Jews with all kinds of assumptions, and for all the diversity that of course is there, it's still at the end of the day not really forced to confront how is Judaism sort of perceived by the other. I mean, I think I always felt that most dramatically as an American in Israel, where, in America, just thinking on the religious plane, Christianity is sort of this big other that's out there that you kind of have to really think about and grapple with. And in Israel, sometimes you get the feeling that it's like a small cult. There's some weird guys that hang out at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and this and that. But like, you know, it's not really a force. And there's a way in which that actually, I think, affects your sort of religious peace. So that's the sense in which, to the extent that, again, halakha is about values, is trying to do things in the world, yeah, any great center should have a robust diaspora. And in that sense, it's not that the diaspora is the equivalent of the center, but is a measure of how vital is Torah, is also how deep into the world can it go and sort of translate something. So that's what I would say on that point. On the standard community piece, it's a very important question here, and I think I'm glad you raised it, because I would distinguish here between kind of theory and practice. I'll first say the thing in theory, which is a sort of radical piece that I actually believe, and then come back to a much more conservative statement when it comes to practice. In theory, I would say to you that there is nothing really fundamentally, as far as HaKadosh Baruch Hu is concerned, more valuable or more weighty about any individual psak and ruling than any other. Nor is there any metaphysical weight of the rabbi or the posek that stands behind any particular position. And in that sense, I think the proper analog of thinking about halachic writing and expertise is the way we think about the interrelationship between medical expertise and public health campaigns. We don't consider it to sort of undermine the medical profession that people increasingly learn, and as a result become more healthy, how to take care of themselves without a doctor having to step in at every point along the way. And we should be thinking that way about halakha in a sort of theoretical sense as well, that yeah, all a posek is someone who, if you knew as much as he or she knows, you would reach that conclusion. But they're not actually, in that sense, fundamentally other than you. And in that sense, on the theoretical plane, someone to come out of here tonight and say, what I heard is that actually this is all about the individual learning to understand what God wants through the mitzvot and the language of halakha and figuring it out how to apply it to their lives, I would say, in hachinami, absolutely, that is what the whole game is. That said, I don't think you want me performing open-heart surgery on you. Right? Even though theoretically, if I went to medical school and did this, not maybe I'd be good at that. But I haven't done that. I don't have that wisdom. I haven't invested in that way. And the reality of what it means to live in community and to have certain standards for what knowledge is, what practice is, what it is to be peer reinforced on all of those things, is that there are people who are potentially better positioned, not because of some special power that they have, but ideally because of some expertise, both in terms of their knowledge and their ability to relate it to people, who are important and critical guides. And the risk, therefore, of going out on your own is not so much a kind of theological risk of heresy. It's simply actually just sort of a potentially idiotic mistake of missing out on wisdom you might not otherwise encounter. I think, you know, in that sense, we do. I think it's a challenge, right? How do we build communities? How do we build communities that are intense and regular and consistent in their practice without descending into an authoritarian culture that discourages thinking? Okay, that's a problem, right? I mean, that's a problem on some level, again, the broader context here. The Western world on some level is struggling with that more broadly. But I do think that the authentic Jewish response to that dilemma is not to say, therefore, you know, mitzvah lishmoa divrei chachamim means, because they're the chachamim invested with a certain kind of authority, you must subordinate yourself to them. But mitzvah lishmoa divrei chachamim, because they're wise. And therefore, you should ideally be seeking that out. And I think the marvelous thing about the modern world is, we sort of decide who those people are. Right? There actually aren't all kinds of communal structures that really endow people with that. Your posek is your posek because you write them the question. Right? In that sense, you actually coronate them to give them that authority as they have it. But I think you're right that we need more of a culture than we've had in a lot of rooms like this one of taking seriously what it means to go to other people for counsel and advice and to say, I'm going to defer to your judgment on this. But that requires a lot of trust.
Okay. think I'm going to start with the question of advice for people training leaders. And I want to warn you that my answer is going to grow more panic as I go. So the first thing I want to say is this. A book came out in Israel a few years ago that broke my heart about American Jewry. The book is called Dear Shuni. It's a collection of Midrashim by Israeli women. And here's the problem. Many of the Midrashim in Dear Shuni are so good that if you were not sort of attuned to the sort of feminist egalitarian project of the Midrashim, you would think they were written by Chazal. Not all, but many. In American Judaism, the possibility of that kind of creativity is laughable. Because essentially what you have, and now in the context of the next 30 minutes, I'm now going to offend virtually every Jew in America, I'm just warning you. Because essentially what you have in America are an awful lot of people who know enough to be creative in that way and have no interest and would even see that kind of creativity as anathema. And an awful lot of people who want to be creative in that way, and in a million years they could never come close to imitating the language of Chazal. You know, I get prayers written by the rabbinical assembly when various things happen. Of course, they're all in English, because there are very few rabbis in the conservative movement who could write liturgical Hebrew, let alone congregants who could understand them. Unless American Jewry can produce something like Dear Shuni, project is more or less over, or at least it's not that interesting. So that's, you know, one piece. So what our aspiration should be, right, is to really raise up people who are so immersed in the language of Torah is their language, that they can say things that were unimaginable to people 100 years ago. Not because they were not in Torah, but because Torah is infinite and keeps playing itself out. That's like a very, very big problem. The other thing that I would say is that I think we live in a time where we face an incredibly interesting paradox around the issue of Judaism and ethics. And I want to make sure I say this carefully and sort of can be heard in everything that I try to say here, okay? Piece one. It is impossible to worship the God of Israel without putting ethics at the very center of your life, let alone your religious life, if those two things could be separated. Right? You want to love God? God says, great, good job, love widows and orphans. Okay? And yet, we live in a time when for an awfully large swath of the American Jewish community, Judaism has been reduced to ethics, and ethics often removed from a serious engagement with sources. Right? We take kids to Washington, we hand them a piece of paper with 15 Jewish words that confirm that, lo and behold, Judaism says whatever their parents think already anyway. Right? It's an enormous problem. You know, it's not for no reason that Michael Wiesegrad has famously lamented, ethics is the Judaism of the assimilated. Right? Now, the problem is that ethics is also the religion of the prophet Isaiah. Right? So this is why, right? And by the way, and I think here, you know, at the risk of painting in extremely broad and unfair strokes, right? You have some denominations in the American Jewish setting that more or less have reduced Judaism to ethics. And other denominations who have reacted to that by more or less becoming less and less interested in ethics. Right? Zebishvila reforming. Right? And the problem is that they are both profound falsifications of Torah. In which, right, it's not secular ethics. With due respect to Levinas, God is not a metaphor for the ethical. God is God. But God loves widows. And if you want to worship God, you strive to love whom God loves. So the question is, can we find a way to actually not distort the role of ethics in the Jewish tradition such that ethics really is at the center, but it is not the only thing? Because another way of saying that is, if there's not anything about Judaism that is distinct from your liberal Upper West Side culture, you don't need it. Theology becomes what many Christian theologians call self-liquidating. Self-liquidating theology is basically theology that leads me to say what I already said beforehand. It's just that I happen to spend 15 minutes hearing a rabbi tell me that it's Jewish. Right? And there's something about that that is sort of, we can put it two ways. Number one, it's sort of impoverished, but number two, it doesn't work. And so, you know, the question is, can we really restore a conversation about God and the ethical, about Torah and the ethical? And by the way, the idea that ethics are central to Torah doesn't mean that ethics is all there is. We also have a whole array of things called mitzvot bin adam l'chaveiro. Like, I'm sorry, mitzvot bin adam l'makom, it's a nice slip, right? Commandments between a person and God, that are not just euphemisms for mitzvot bin adam l'chaveiro. They are actually about trying to have a relationship to something or someone transcendent. The last thing I would say to people training leaders here, and here's the moment where I'm going to sound a little crazy. Time is running out, folks. It is not the case that the center will not hold. The center has already disappeared. Go home and study the New York population study. Just study it for a while and ask yourself, like, ladies and gentlemen, you have purchased a concession on the Titanic. Unless we fundamentally decide, this is not just about me and sort of I have this idiosyncratic take on Judaism. It is about deciding that one is committed to trying to create a Judaism that is, not to, by the way, to create a Jewish community. Not to create a Judaism, to create a Jewish community that is thoroughly immersed and rooted in Jewish sources and conversation, that experiences them as Torah, not as cultural artifacts, and that is unapologetically committed to the ways in which some of those things can play out in the modern world differently than they played out before. I often worry that many liberal rabbis in America are kind of busy, like, you know, fixing this little thing or that little thing, or figuring out, like, how we can get 9 people to Kabbalah Shabbat instead of 8. Meanwhile, folks, the whole thing, the ship is sinking. And either we take responsibility for it, either we believe in Torah enough, or in this vision of Torah enough to build something, or, like all Jews who are somewhat liberal, we will not have grandchildren either, because they'll be Christians or Haredim. And it actually, I think, to be a Jew in this moment, and it's not just about leaders, but it's especially leaders, is to take responsibility. Because we live in a moment of profound, 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 profound crisis around those questions. I say that because I am not a defeatist, right? I think it's actually the case. Here's 2 things I take comfort in. As Professor Avigdor Shinan once said to me many years ago, I asked him a question. I said, Professor Shinan, what did Chazal think about this? For some reason, he was in a sort of whimsical mood, and he said, "Ani rotze lasbir lecha mashu. Ma ze Chazal? Ze 600 ish be 600 shana. What is Chazal? It's 600 people over 600 years. It's nobody. They were nobody. And they fundamentally faced change the face of the Jewish world. And if you think that a small group can't change the faith of the Jewish world, I have one word for you. Art scroll." So instead of liberal Jews making fun of art scroll, create your own art scroll. That's why I have like no time for like conservative rabbis who make fun of people for using art scroll, right? Because we're busy learning the Vilna Shas, right? I mean, it's crazy, right? So make your own. So find a way to recreate something powerful and real, because time is not on your side, on our side. Now, you asked a question about faith. I'm going to try to answer, but I have to confess that I'm not sure I understood it. So if I totally evade your question, it's not intentional. And you can ask me again after. I think one of the reasons we would want to have faith is because many of us have really profound intuitions that what is in front of us is not what's ultimate. That things that are not empirically obvious are the realest things in the world. Right? What someone should have said long ago when logical positivism emerged, the notion that only that which is measurable was real, is the following. Love, 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 love. What you just said is uninteresting. It's not just wrong, it's uninteresting. Right? Because things that are not empirically obvious are often the realest things in the world. Commitment, fidelity. And for many of us, and to go back to Eric's question, not all of us, and certainly not all of us in the modern world, something or someone transcendent is part of that too. And for many of us, I think probably for almost all of us some of the time, and for some of us close to all of the time, there is a sense that something greater than us and greater than human makes a claim on us. And that may be one of the realest and deepest things we know. Now, can you just call that the ethical? You can. Some people do. That's not my experience of what it is, meaning that doesn't exhaust what it is. Because I experience that as also transcendent in some way. So I think those are actually good reasons to want to have faith. I'm going to stop there.
We're out of time, even though the conversation has a lot more places it could go. I want to thank my colleague, Rabbi Shahel.
Thank you.
For coming out and two sort of practical pitches coming out of this. The first is both of us, I think you heard, hitting notes that we feel very passionately about these kinds of conversations not ultimately being about the theory and the intellectual exploration, but about being creating a Jewish community in real ways on the ground. Thank you for being a part of that by being here tonight. This space is about being a Makom Torah, a place of serious learning for the broader Jewish community, and whether it's our shiurim on Monday nights or the lecture events like this on Tuesday nights, various classes that you can take here during the summer, our executive seminar during the second week of July. These are incredible opportunities, I think, not just for enrichment for yourself, but to actually be part of the engine of creating Jewish life, learning, and practice on the ground. And in the spirit of that, as we close here, we'll have a few minutes of people finding their place and chatting a bit. We're going to move in just a few minutes to Tfilat Arvit, to the evening service, which you are welcome to stay for, which there are some books that are up on that shelf over there, and we can also help connect you if you're looking for one. And yes, the next event to be here for a real happening evening is June 10th. We would love to see you all back on Monday night, June 10th, and we'll be having a kickoff evening of learning and speaking and schmoozing and celebration for the beginning of our summer session, which begins on June 9th, June 10th, Monday evening. Mark it down on your calendars, 7:30 p.m. There'll be a number of shiurim, a number of classes, and then a closing address by my colleague, Rabbi Hill. So thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.